Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This year's WNBA season will open as scheduled, unless it doesn't. Last night, NBA Commissioner David Stern's deadline for a new WNBA collective bargaining agreement came and went, and thus far the league and the Players Association haven't even agreed on whether a deal has been reached. WNBA Commissioner Val Ackerman released a statement last night saying, quote, "Substantial progress has been made toward a new collective bargaining agreement, and negotiations will continue over the weekend." The Players Association, on the other hand, said a deal had been struck and triumphantly announced the terms. Only a Game's Karen Given sorts through the rubble.
In late December of 1999, when the WNBA's rival, the American Basketball League, folded, the ABL used its answering machine to update players on the status of bankruptcy proceedings.
The league is currently working on a plan to assure that you will be paid as much of your salary as possible for the month of December. This plan is subject to court approval, however.
So maybe it's fitting that the deal that could save the WNBA from sharing the fate of the ABL was announced last night on the answering machine of WNBA Players Association spokesman Dan Wasserman.
A little while ago, the WNBPA informed the WNBA that they had accepted the terms of their last offer. The vote taken by the player membership came out at 56% voting in favor of the deal, 44% voting against the deal. Some of the highlights of the deal include...
Wasserman goes on to list a number of victories by the Players Association in the new collective bargaining agreement, a list that might sound more like concessions to players close to the negotiations. The five-year agreement will go 2 years longer than the players wanted. The minimum salary for veterans will increase 5% from $40,000 to $42,000. The players had pushed for a 20% increase, and the players gained a free agency clause, though not the one they wanted. Even though WNBA players are paid substantially less than their male counterparts, Denver-based sports marketing consultant Dean Bonham says the pressure was on the players to strike a deal. That's because, Bonham says, the league simply doesn't have the money to pay them more.
Are these players worth more? Do they provide more entertainment value? In the end, are they going to be the economic underpinning of a very successful league that will deliver, I think, incredible economic results for the league and the NBA? The answer to all that is yes. I think it's all a question of timing. When can you get closer to the real value that you present? And I just don't think the time is now.
None of the details have been confirmed by the WNBA, but Bonham says it's in the best interest of both parties to come to an agreement, because if a deal isn't reached to play this season, it would likely signal the end of the WNBA.
This is a league that is, to be kind, immature. An immature league can't afford to be out of business for a year and not be presenting its brand, its product, its players, its case for women's sports throughout their season.
In the absence of a new collective bargaining agreement, the WNBA's 2003 college draft, originally scheduled for earlier this week, was postponed. The league says the draft and other events will stay on hold until an agreement is signed. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
The NBA playoffs begin today, so Sacramento Bee columnist Scott Howard Cooper joins me now on the line. Scott, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be with you again.
The Los Angeles Lakers were only an average road team during the regular season. They play Minnesota, which has home court advantage starting tomorrow. Will the Timberwolves end this dream of a four-peat before it can really get rolling?
I think the Lakers will continue their dream, unfortunately, for Minnesota, which has had a season that in many ways is commendable. I think if you would have told the people of the Twin Cities at the start of the year that they would have so many injury problems and that they'd have to bring in some new players to play key roles and they would still end up number four, they'd be you'd be having a parade down by Target Center. The problem being that the big float coming right down Nicollet Mall right now is Shaquille O'Neal. So that's a problem.
Well, whether or not the Lakers prevail in the opening round series, I cannot think of a number five seed that has ever struck more fear into the hearts of potential opponents as the playoffs begin. Can you?
Well, strictly because they're a very unique team in that they have the one player in the league that nobody could match up against. There's been teams that have been championship caliber and been at number five or lower. Actually, the Houston Rockets were defending champions and went all the way from number six to winning a championship. But that was a year that the Rockets had a great deal of injuries more than anything. This year, the Lakers had some injuries. They had the usual internal problems, and I think it basically they just sort of left their wake-up call for mid-February, as always, and now they're kicking it into gear. But the reason they strike so much fear into people, as you said, is because of Shaquille O'Neal. Kobe Bryant is a marvelously talented player, but Shaq is the one guy that nobody really has an answer for.
The Timberwolves or the Lakers would likely have to beat San Antonio and then Sacramento or Dallas to advance to the finals. I would think any Western Conference team has got to be looking at that bracket and saying, whoa, this is daunting.
There's no such thing as an easy road. You know, I think at the start of the year, a lot of people felt like it was probably four of the elite teams in the Western Conference, and now Minnesota sort of putting itself in that same group just by claiming the number four spot and home court advantage, because the Timberwolves have played so well at Target Center. But there's no question. It's a treacherous path out there for whoever is going to make it. There's all sorts of different kinds of problems. You can get San Antonio, which is all about composure and defense and solid and just sort of doing things right, or you can get a team like Dallas or Sacramento, which is like being on the Autobahn, and they'll just want to try to run you up and down the court. So not only are there several good teams out there, but there's contrasting styles as well.
What about the teams at the bottom in the West, the Portlands and Utahs and Phoenixes of the world? Are they contenders as well? Should we take them seriously?
Well, I think among that group, Portland is the one that is, you know, has the potential to make things interesting, but for who remains to be seen. That's always been the biggest problem with the Trailblazers, a team with the capability to do a lot of damage. You know, there's some talent on that team, and they're big and athletic and they're deep, but the problem is they also can do a great deal of damage to themselves. That's been the reputation, and it's been well earned on the Timberwolves' part. They'll get on each other, and I think if they lose in the first round, you're going to hear an awful lot of sniping coming out of there as always. I think in the case of Phoenix, it's been a terrific season already. I think that they're one of the great success stories of the season, just making it this far. So losing in the first round would not be anything to feel bad about. This is a team that did play San Antonio well during the regular season, so I don't think that they're just going to be rolling over. Utah, the most interesting situation of all of those teams that we just mentioned, because they have the ability to sort of take the Kings, a team that we mentioned a minute ago, wants to try to run the ball and move as fast as possible. Utah will try to turn it into much more of a grind-it-out style. And this comes at the same time that this could be the farewell tour for John Stockton and Karl Malone playing together in Utah. I think that they've been there longer than the Wasatch Front, but now this could be the end.
In the East, the Detroit Pistons are the number one seed. Is Detroit, in fact, the strongest Eastern team, the one most likely to challenge for a championship?
Well, the East is a different situation than the West because it's much more middle of the road. You don't have anybody in the East, I think, that people right now would pick to win a championship, but that you have among that group of middle of the road several teams that I don't think anybody would be terribly surprised if you said that there could be five teams that would come out of there that could be the winner. Detroit is a team that wins with defense. They need to get more offense than they did at many times during the regular season. And hopefully they'll, you know, for their sake, they need to pick it up offensively in the playoffs, because that's what really hurt them last year. A very good defensive team that does a lot of things right. They pass the ball, they play as a team, they defend, they play smart. They do a lot of things very, very well. The big thing to keep in mind there is the health of Ben Wallace. They say he's going to be ready to go. He had been hurt. He came back faster than expected. If he continues to labor along, even if he does play, that's a big problem for the Pistons.
Anybody else in the East that you would say, well, you know, I wouldn't mind putting a long shot bet on him?
Well, I'm not sure about long shot. Like I said, since there's so many teams in there, I think Indiana has the ability to regroup and get back to where it was earlier in the season. I like New Orleans. That was my pick at the start of the year, and maybe I'm staying with the Hornets just because I hate people that sort of jump off the bandwagon in the middle of the road. But the Hornets have some size. They defend. They've got scorers. They've got several ball handlers. I think it's a complete team that does have the ability to win the East. Obviously, you don't want to overlook New Jersey, the defending Eastern Conference champions. That's a team that still does a lot of things right. Jason Kidd is a marvelous player. I think the Nets are going to be bringing it as well.
For the first time since 1984, when the league adopted a best-of-five opening round format, the conference quarterfinals will be best-of-seven. Are there teams that benefit from this or teams that suffer as a result of the change?
Well, there's half the teams that benefit and half the teams that suffer. The better teams benefit. And I say this knowing that Anaheim just beat Detroit in the NHL playoffs in a huge upset, and that was best of seven as well. But I think most people seem to agree that best of seven cuts down the chances dramatically of an upset, and especially a big upset, because when you get into a best of five, the underdog comes in and steals one. It changes the dynamics, and then if they get a little confidence, you know, now having to get to four wins in seven games, I think, is a much tougher journey. I think it's a very big step. It cuts down the chances of those fluke series victories.
Scott Howard Cooper covers the NBA for the Sacramento Bee, and he's a regular here at Only a Game as well. Scott, thanks again.
Have a good day.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
Took off that mask. Don't think you should show your face around here.
While campaigning for a seat in the local assembly of Tokyo, professional wrestler Masanori Murakawa, who wrestles under the name of the Great Suzuki, wore the same mask that he wears in the ring, a black and white full face creation featuring bright red streaks and a golden wing next to each eye hole. Having won the assembly seat, the Great Suzuki now says that he will wear the mask to work, since, quote, I won the support of the voters with this face, and to take it off would be breaking promises. The Great Suzuki, who suffered an ankle injury stumbling over a curb during the campaign, also said that he now hopes to demonstrate his, quote, superabundant power outside of the ring as well as within it.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Tens of thousands of Baghdad protesters yesterday demanded that the United States get out of Iraq. You can read more about the story at WBUR.org. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide. Thought Forms, recently named Custom Builder of the Year by Custom Home Magazine. Their work can be viewed at thoughtforms-corp.com. And Beverly Hospital's Geriatric Care Center, providing a comprehensive array of primary and specialty care services for the elderly and their families. beverlyhospital.org/geriatric. The forecast after some morning clouds, mostly sunny with highs 50 to 55 degrees, but in the 40s on Cape Cod and the islands. Mostly clear tonight, lows in the mid-30s. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid-50s. Patriots Day cloudy with highs 50 to 55. It's 38 degrees in Boston at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, Capitol fans bid his airness adieu. But first, at long last, an American is the world's number one fencer. 24-year-old saber fencer Keith Smart is a Brooklyn resident who got his start in a unique program run by American pioneer Peter Westbrook that teaches inner-city kids the joys and discipline of fencing. Only a Game's John Kalish reports.
Fencing isn't exactly the rage in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. Just ask one former resident, Keith Smart.
Most of my friends, they never heard of fencing. And I would walk home with my fencing equipment, and things are like, what is this? You know, like, are you Zorro or something? They just didn't understand. They couldn't grasp the concept of fencing or let alone, like, somebody Black or Caribbean fencing. So it was, like, completely bizarre to them. And they started to accept it once they saw that I was going on trips to competitions. Once they saw that I was away every weekend, it helped.
In 1996, Smart went to St. John's University in New York on a fencing scholarship. He made the U.S. Olympic team in 2000, won the National Saber Championship last year, and was recently rated the number one saber fencer in the world. The lanky six-footer still works with his college coach, Yuri Gelman, who coached the Ukrainian national team before he came to the United States.
His timing is very unique. He cuts in very unusual time and people do not expect it. And his technique is very unusual also, very different. And I don't change it because like God gave it to him, so why I will change it?
Gelman says it's incredible Smart can compete with his European counterparts who are professionals who fence full time. Herbie Reynaud, a 31-year-old saber fencer and U.S. national team member, says that though Smart is physically gifted, that's not his greatest asset.
What makes Keith an exceptional fencer is his mind, really, more than anything else. His will to win is unbelievable, and that's one of the reasons why I enjoy being on the team with him. He's so competitive, and, you know, he just works really hard. You know, I think everybody here works really hard, but I think the mind game, I think Keith has mastered it better than anybody else.
Reynaud is on the coaching staff at the Peter Westbrook Foundation, which was started in 1991 to provide fencing training and academic tutoring to inner-city kids. Both Keith Smart and his sister Erin, who is currently the number two ranked women's foil fencer in the country, trained at the Westbrook Foundation. 8 of the 24 fencers on the U.S. national fencing team are African Americans who either graduated from the foundation's fencing program or currently teach in it. The coaching staff includes Robert Cottingham, an attorney who serves on the staff of a New Jersey congressman, and Lázaro Mora, a member of the Cuban Olympic team who defected to the U.S. on a crude wooden boat. Each Saturday morning, more than 100 youngsters, the majority of them black and Hispanic, work out at the New York Fencing Club in Manhattan, the oldest fencing club in the country. Presiding over the three-hour session is 51-year-old Peter Westbrook.
On guard. On guard, man. Double advanced line.
Westbrook won a bronze medal in saber fencing at the 1984 Olympics in Atlanta. He fenced competitively into his 40s, which is unheard of in the sport. Westbrook lives in Harlem and devotes all of his time to the Peter Westbrook Foundation. Westbrook's father was an African American and his mother was Japanese. The family grew up poor in a public housing project in Newark, New Jersey, which was a rough place back then. In an effort to keep him off the streets and out of trouble, Westbrook's mother bribed him into taking fencing lessons his first year of high school.
I loved it from the beginning because fencing is a fighting sport. And in my family, my mother used to hit me. In the schools, people used to hit me. I used to hit people. In the environment and neighborhood, it was always fighting. So to me, fencing seemed like a natural fighting sport. To me, it kind of fit in with everything that I've been through in my whole life and in the community.
Westbrook went to a predominantly Italian Catholic high school where he was the only black athlete on the fencing team. He quickly became a standout and went to New York University on a scholarship in 1970. Westbrook won the NCAA championship his senior year. After college, he held the national saber fencing title for an unprecedented 13 years and took home 3 gold medals from the Pan American Games. When he won his bronze medal at the 1984 Olympics, it was the first time in 24 years an American had won a medal in fencing. That was back in the days when fencing bouts were judged by humans. Today, points are awarded electronically. Weapons and protective gear are wired, so a light goes off whenever a touch is made. Westbrook says that when he fenced competitively, the judges often discriminated against him.
I had sometimes to cut the guy in half, and I would get the touch. But if I would hit him normally, many times, no. Is that biasness? That's not biasness. That's downright blatant cheating. So that's what I had to put up with.
Westbrook is confident that fencers like 16-year-old Nemo Wooten will enjoy a level playing field. She's a high school sophomore in Maplewood, New Jersey.
At first, I didn't want to do it. My father said it would be a good idea for scholarship. And he started bringing me here, and I do saber. And I like it a lot. It's kind of overwhelming because you learn the basics and a lot of this stuff. But while you're doing it, every Saturday seems to come together a little more. So
parents seem to be keen on Peter Westbrook. Marva Prescott has 2 daughters who've been fencing for a year and a half. On a recent Saturday morning, she sat watching her 10 and 12-year-old girls practice.
I love to come here on Saturdays. I love to hear Peter talk. He's jovial. He tells about his life stories, what it's about integrity, about hard work, about choosing a mate, about messing up. He prepares them for life outside. It's not just a fencing program. It's way beyond that.
Prescott says the opportunity to rub elbows with top-rated fencers such as Keith Smart has had a big impact on her daughters.
Keith being the number one in the world now has given them a new impetus and a new drive. And it's, you know, they know Keith, they talk to him. If Keith can do it, maybe we can do it. So, hey, let's go for it.
In America, fencing doesn't enjoy the popularity it does in Europe. But Westbrook, who still beats Keith Smart from time to time, says the quality of fencing here is on the upswing.
We had, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, a lot of those coaches from different countries migrated here, and now we have a lot of great coaches in America. So fencing in America is being built up like you wouldn't believe.
Westbrook is proud of his staff and his students, who may be as old as 20 or 30, but to him, they're still kids. He predicts that as many as 4 or 5 of the 9 fencers on the U.S. team at the 2004 Athens Olympics will be African-American. Black fencers will certainly appear in an upcoming Disney movie about the life of Peter Westbrook. For Only a Game, I'm John Kalish in New York.
Nice ball. Hoppa.
For some years now, Major League Baseball's owners, led by one of their own, Commissioner Bud Selig, have been arguing that unless the economic underpinnings of their game change, the competitive pennant race will disappear and the business of baseball will be doomed. Players, aware that franchises are selling for higher and higher prices even as they allegedly lose money, have been skeptical. In May the Best Team Win, economist Andrew Zimbalist addresses that conflict and much else regarding the business of the game. He joins me now from the studios of WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Professor Zimbalist, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill.
Early in May the Best Team Win, you point out that Commissioner Selig has constantly exaggerated the economic distress of the owners, sometimes even representing profits as losses. Did nobody check his math before Major League Baseball signed the latest collective bargaining agreement?
I think that the Players Association is duly skeptical about the claimed losses by the owners. But by the same token, whether the owners have in the aggregate a $10 million profit or a $10 million loss isn't going to have a lot of impact on the final terms of the collective bargaining agreement. I think one of the more interesting problems in the collective bargaining agreement is that the owners weren't willing to engage in substantive discussion of the major points until the very end of the process. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the agreement that was finally produced was completely misengineered, and the incentive system in the agreement is perverse so that the kinds of things that they wanted to accomplish won't be accomplished.
Tell me a little bit specifically about that perversity you've referred to.
Well, one of the problems in this agreement is that they're using a revenue-sharing system that ends up having a marginal tax rate on the bottom revenue teams of close to 50%. And that means that every time the Kansas City Royals generate another $1 million in revenue, that Major League Baseball gives them $0.5 million less in revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. So that if David Glass is thinking about, gee, do I want to spend more money on my payroll and have a better team and therefore generate more revenue, he's thinking about, well, I can spend $10 million for this player. The player might generate $12 million in revenue for me. Under ordinary circumstances, that's a good deal. I'll take it. But under the circumstances that they have in the new collective bargaining agreement, that $12 million becomes a net $6 million to him. And so it's no longer worth it. And Glass, and as a consequence, Glass is no longer interested in investing in his team. And we see that in spite of the fact that Glass is going to be getting $19 million in revenue sharing from Major League Baseball, that he's actually lowering his payroll this year by $11 million. So the whole effort to increase competitive balance is not going to work out because of the strange incentives.
Part of the difficulty in pinning down the numbers is that, for example, a man who owns a stadium and a team can assign the profits to the stadium and the expenses to the team and then claim the team is losing a lot of money. I've oversimplified that situation, but have I got it essentially right?
That's essentially right. And it's not just stadiums. It's also local media companies, and it's also local or national concessionaire companies. Wherever there's a what's called a related party transaction, where the owner owns both the team and a business that's related to the team, the owner can shuffle the revenues and the costs between those two entities as he sees fit.
The central claim of the owners, both before and after the latest collective bargaining agreement was signed, has been that very wealthy teams, the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Braves, and a few others, have a competitive advantage so profound that teams with less money, and in some cases much less money, essentially have no chance. This means fans in those cities will lose interest if they haven't already done so. Does the recent success of teams like Oakland and Minnesota derail that argument, or are those just exceptions that strengthen the argument?
Well, I don't think they're exceptions that strengthen the argument, but they are, as the good commissioner is wont to say, aberrations. If you look at the statistical correlation or relationship between payroll and team winning percentage since 1995, you have a much higher probability of success if you have a higher payroll, as was true between 1995 and 2001, that out of 224 playoff games in the postseason, only five of them were won by teams in the bottom half of payrolls. Mm-hmm. That's a winning percentage of 978 for the teams in the top half. And you know, that does skew the competitive balance on the playing field, and it does greatly shift the odds against the low-revenue teams from having success. And over time, it has to diminish fan interest. And if it's happening to half the teams or even a third of the teams, it's a major cost and a major issue for Major League Baseball.
In the last several negotiations between the owners and the players, in the most recent collective bargaining agreement, we had the introduction of the admittedly flawed revenue sharing system that you've mentioned, and we've got a luxury tax which essentially penalizes the teams with the highest payrolls. Once both sides have had a chance to tinker with these tools, are they tools that can work?
Yeah, I think that they can. You know, again, the problem is that it's improperly engineered, and the reason it's improperly engineered is because of the contentious and unproductive collective bargaining relationship, so that the two sides don't sit down early enough and think about and study the problem and plan rationally for the long-term future of the game. And what they need to do here in a revenue-sharing system, and it's certainly possible, is to share from the top to the bottom, not based upon team revenues, but based upon the inherent value of a team in different markets, so that the Yankees should certainly share money, a lot of money, from the top to the bottom teams, but the Yankees should not be penalized for having a winning record, or the Red Sox should not be penalized for having a winning record, and the Kansas City Royals and the Tampa Bay Devil Rays and the Minnesota Twins should not be rewarded for having a losing record. They can get a set amount of revenue sharing if they're in a small market. They can get a set amount, but that amount should not go up if they have a worse team.
In the final chapter of May the Best Team Win, you say, quote, Bud Selig's behavior since 1999 serves as an anti-model. It's a great phrase. Can baseball survive many more years under Mr. Selig's management?
Well, you know, first of all, I of course think baseball has many problems and many issues, but I also feel that baseball is very deeply ingrained in the United States culture, and they're doing okay. You know, they've got television contracts that go through 2006. Mm-hmm. They've got lots of new stadiums. In fact, most front offices in baseball are being managed more professionally and more effectively. Baseball is going to survive whether or not Selig is there. And Selig himself has some good qualities and characteristics. So I think, yes, the answer is yes. Baseball will survive if Bud Selig is there for another year or two or even 4 or 5 years. The question is, though, not whether it's going to survive, but how well it survives and whether or not it flourishes, and how much can it push itself forward. I don't think Bud Selig's the right man to push sports forward. He's been the commissioner since 1992. It was inappropriate to have him installed in 1992 as a part-time commissioner. It's inappropriate in 1998 when they installed him as the permanent commissioner. It's inappropriate because he's an owner, and his family owns the Milwaukee Brewers, whether or not his name is on the top of the masthead since 1998. And the very appearance of conflict of interest challenges his legitimacy and I think undermines his ability to effectively guide the sport.
Andrew Zimblist is a professor at Smith College, and he is the author of May the Best Team Win, subtitled Baseball Economics and Public Policy from Brookings Press. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
It was my pleasure, Bill. Good to talk to you again.
Picture me pinching you kisses when the morning train is due. And when day is done, if it's raining, hun, I'll come sliding back to you. Oh, you better play ball with me. What a manager you could be. Let's give love a cloud. Honey, don't hold out. You better play ball with me, yeah. Spitball, greaseball, you better play ball with me.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment. On the web at thermo.com, and from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a grocery store where shoppers will find a variety of foods and beverages, like artisan breads, heat-and-eat entrees, and a myriad of cheeses. TraderJoe's.com. The Boston Philharmonic, Benjamin Zander conducting, presenting Debussy's Chansons, Harbison, Saint-Saëns, and Ravel, April 24th, 26th, and 27th. And Adesso, adjoining the Four Seasons Hotel, featuring the Ligne Rosé Furniture Collection, open 7 days a week and online at the redesigned site, AdessoBoston.com. Good morning, I'm Bob C. in Boston, and in sports, the Boston Red Sox defeated the Toronto Blue Jays by a score of 7-3. The Sox trailed by 3-2 going into the seventh inning, but then broke the game open when Toronto reliever Jeff Tam walked four consecutive batters. Tim Wakefield got the victory. The Boston Celtics start their journey toward the NBA Finals today in Indianapolis when they take on the Indiana Pacers in the first game of their best-of-seven series. Game two will be on Monday. Join us for an exploration of the lush landscape and fascinating culture of Ireland on our next Citizens of the World tour this summer. To learn more, log on to WBUR.org or call 1-800-909-9287. The weather forecast calls for mostly sunny skies later today, possibly in the 50s and the 40s on Cape Cod and the islands. Clear skies tonight, lows in the mid-30s and mostly sunny on Sunday. In Boston now, 38 degrees.
I'm Dick Gordon, host of The Connection. On behalf of everyone here at WBUR, we'd like to say thank you for contributing during our spring fundraiser. It's support from listeners just like you that makes what we do possible. We made our goal thanks to your generous support. Now we can continue to provide the kind of quality news and thoughtful analysis you expect from us. Thanks again. And now, back to the news.
Littlefield. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a visit to Arizona's Handball Hall of Fame. But first, a look at the week's sports news with our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It's NBA playoff time. The Lakers, lacking home court advantage against the Timberwolves, will try to make it four in a row, and there are, I'm sure, additional postseason matters to consider.
Yeah, but the Lakers are by far the most compelling story. They're the most interesting team. They're the team that's come the furthest. They're the defending champions. They have the two of the five most compelling players in the league, and they're playing a Minnesota team virtually being carried by Kevin Garnett, who, if there wasn't a Tim Duncan, would be the most valuable player in the league. The interesting thing about the NBA, besides the fact that, like the NHL, all of its power is in its western half, is the fact that the one team, I believe, in the West that doesn't become a puddle in their shoes when they play the Lakers, the San Antonio Spurs, will have to play them in the second round. Mm.
The Washington Wizards did not make the playoffs, and so Michael Jordan's basketball days are allegedly over, underlined twice, allegedly. What can we say retrospectively about Jordan's career on the occasion of his third retirement beyond what we could have said in 1993 or in 1998?
Absolutely nothing. I mean, this has been a purposeless exercise ever since he got to Washington. The team is falling apart. He's bailing out. Donald Rumsfeld somehow had found time to leave the reconstruction of Iraq to give him a flag. There was talk about retiring Michael Jordan's number 23 in every NBA arena, which if they do that, they should retire Larry Bird's 33 and Magic Johnson's 32 first before they do Michael's, because that's the order of things. The presence of Michael Jordan has just become a great big pain in the neck, and we can only hope that this is a permanent retirement.
Toronto head coach Lenny Wilkins, the NBA's record holder for wins and, as of quite recently, losses as well, is now free to sign on with another team next year. Maybe we should have seen this coming after the Raptors lost on Tuesday night and general manager Glenn Grunwald grabbed a microphone and pulled a nutty worthy of Howard Beale, the news anchor and network, don't you think?
Yeah, he got on the microphone after they lost the Heat and announced, "We will not stand for this any longer."
He's mad as hell and not going to take it.
Is it too much to expect that, given the nature of the Toronto Raptors, he should have just gotten the microphone and announced his own resignation?
The most surprising result in round one of the National Hockey League playoffs found the Anaheim Mighty Ducks still for sale, sweeping the Detroit Red Wings, the defending Stanley Cup champs. Tell me that you saw this one coming, Charlie.
I didn't see this one coming at all, because there was absolutely no reason to assume that this could happen, given the way that Detroit played the whole season.
The other Disney team previously available, the Angels, will apparently be sold to a Phoenix businessman, Arturo Moreno, for $180 million, and maybe a change in ownership will finally bring a World Series championship to those long-suffering fans in Anaheim.
Yeah, Mr. Moreno, who's now the first Mexican-American to be the majority owner of a major league team, is worth $940 million, mostly on outdoor advertising, which means billboard magnate, by the way.
There you go.
Which is sort of moving down the media food chain from Disney, the more I think about it. Certainly Disney is selling at the right time. This is a very good price. This is almost a $40 million profit for Disney, which, of course, is boutonniere money.
Well, help me out with this, though. The Angels are world champs.
Correct.
The Red Sox, having failed to win a World Series since 1918, recently sold for over $700 million. Help me with the math.
Well, Back Bay Boston real estate versus the swamps of Anaheim.
Easy. Charges that over the past decade or so, numbers of positive drug tests on U.S. Olympic athletes were covered up have surfaced once again, Charlie. Are we talking the odd cold capsule here or something much more systematic and devious?
Well, it depends who you talk to. It does, however, illustrate the fact that any drug testing program of this kind is vulnerable to either being tinkered with at the time or ultimately having its confidentiality blown. The former USOC director for drug control from 1991 to 2000, a guy named Dr. Wade Exum, just simply released 30 pages of documents to Sports Illustrated, willy-nilly. You know, I mean, some of it could be cold medicine, some of it could be something more serious, but the fact is that nobody in the International Olympic Committee wants to make the Americans angry because the Americans own the television networks. And without American athletes, most of these buffet cowboys would have to go back to doing whatever it was they did before they got on the gravy train.
On Tuesday night, on the Chicago White Sox home field, Eric Dybas attacked an umpire, and he's now been charged with felony aggravated battery. Commissioner Budd is calling for increased security. One wonders why that call didn't go out roughly a year ago at this time in the same venue.
Well, I mean, last September, yards away from where this lunacy happened, a Kansas City coach named Tom Gamboa was beaten up by a father and son tag team.
Exactly.
Look, the problem with increased security and the problem with solving this problem forever is that it will cost people money, and Commissioner Budd and the rest of his owners don't want to do that. So I think, basically they're going to continue to tinker and, with all due respect to the Anaheim Angels, Mickey Mouse their way towards trying to solve this problem, and it isn't going to be solved. There's always going to be more lunatics than there are people to guard them.
And there's always going to be alcohol sales at ballparks,
because
that's what pays the freight.
And there is absolutely no way to divorce the culture of beer from the culture of baseball.
Today is the last day that you can go to Jose Canseco's website and bid on an afternoon with Jose at his place in Florida. Bids range curiously from $0 to $1 billion. But I wonder if the winner has to be under house arrest in order to claim his prize.
That was of course typed in the full Dr. Evil dialect. $1 billion. Yeah, Jose Canseco, lonely in his house arrest, is auctioning off his companionship. The very real problem is that you sort of have to spend, like, the whole time with Jose in his house.
Florida's nice enough if you'd have to...
You can't even go to the beach because Jose can't leave his house.
Finally, Charlie, on Tuesday, doctors in Nice, France, offered evidence that World Cup victory is good for heart health. Perhaps before long, the World Health Organization will recommend having World Cup tournaments, I don't know, every 6 months, every couple of days.
Bill, it doesn't matter how healthy your heart is if you're standing there while a Scotsman is hitting you in the head with a brick.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine and, of course, joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
There's more news this week suggesting the long-standing marriage between automobile racing and tobacco companies may be coming to an end, just weeks after RJR hinted that it was considering leaving NASCAR and ahead of a global ban on tobacco advertising set to take effect in 2006 or sooner. The BMW Williams Formula One team has announced a first. This weekend at the San Marino Grand Prix in Italy, Williams cars will display advertising for a range of products designed to help smokers quit. Joining me on the line from Italy is Williams Marketing Director Jim Wright. Jim, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Williams cars have been smoke-free for 3 years, ever since the team joined up with anti-smoking BMW. But for a long time, the conventional wisdom was that Formula One teams could not survive without tobacco sponsorship. Has post-tobacco life been difficult?
I have to say no. I have to say that the revenues we are generating now from sponsorship are far in excess of where we were with tobacco back in 1999. And we've gone out and sourced money from IT companies like HP, financial services companies, and now obviously smoking cessation brand Nicotine CQ. So we're working hard, and life after tobacco for us is very good.
Your team has presented this new sponsorship as, quote, anti-smoking, but we're talking about a major pharmaceutical company here. Is the sponsorship about public health or about the bottom line, or can it be about both?
I think first and foremost, it's a commercial opportunity. I think the guys from GlaxoSmithKline have realized that for 30 years, Formula One has been bombarded with tobacco messaging. And I think to come in with a smoking cessation product into this marketplace makes eminent sense.
Given the success that you've talked about with your team, do you see this spilling over into NASCAR? Does NASCAR become free of tobacco sponsorship as well at some point?
Why not? I think there are opportunities now for all forms of motorsport to look at our lead and say, well, why not smoking cessation products in NASCAR? Yeah, why not?
It's a little hard to imagine in some ways, you know. I mean, I know the good old boy is a cliche, but, you know, with a chunk of tobacco in his cheek and a cigarette in his lips, is he going to buy this?
Yeah, but attitudes have changed, haven't they? I think people are now saying, hold on, maybe it was cool to smoke, but I tell you what, it's now cool to quit smoking. And I think attitudes have changed, and therefore the timing of this kind of sponsorship is spot on.
Starting in 2006, or perhaps 2005, if the European Union has its way, tobacco sponsorship will be banned entirely, and many experts have said that this will be a dark day for automobile racing. Do you think that there is cause for other teams to be concerned and the racing industry in general?
There shouldn't be, and there's two reasons why. The first reason is that Formula One has had plenty of time to prepare itself for the day when tobacco is leaving. So there's no excuse for not being out in the marketplace and looking for replacements. Secondly, Formula One is a very attractive marketing proposition. We draw over 300 million TV viewers for every race, and we have 16 races per year. So it's a very marketable concern. And I think if you look at almost any sector of business or commerce, Formula One has appeal.
Jim Wright is the marketing director for the BMW Williams Formula One team. Jim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Imagine you visit Cooperstown, and as you look at the bronze plaques of former baseball greats, you bump into Willie Mays, Nolan Ryan, and Cal Ripken Jr. At Tucson, Arizona's Handball Hall of Fame and Museum, that sort of brush with greatness is not only possible for fans of the sport, it's also probable. Recently, Arizona Public Radio's Ann Hepperman attended the annual Masters Singles Tournament in Tucson, and she has this report.
It's easy to miss the Handball Hall of Fame. The small stucco building used to be a convenience store. Now a convenience store is located next door, where Patricia Gutierrez works. Ask her what it's like to be so close to the Hall of Fame on a daily basis, and you'll get this answer.
I've heard of handball, but I have no idea why it would be in Tucson. You would think it'd be somewhere grand or maybe even Phoenix, but I don't know about here in Tucson.
But, says United States Handball Association President Vern Roberts, the Handball Hall of Fame is set up for a particular and devoted audience, those who recognize Tucson's been a handball hotbed since 1981.
If they retired from the fire department back in New York and they were young, they came out here to play handball. If somebody was in college and wanted to get good at handball, they came to Tucson because this is where the people were to make it happen.
A walk through the museum is a bit like you've stepped into your grandparents' attic. That is, if your grandparents are handball fanatics. A somewhat disorganized collection of old handballs, photos, and trophies sits behind the plexiglass. Plaques and portraits cover the walls. But unlike most museums, the occasional foray into a display case is not unwelcome. Vern Roberts reaches inside one and presents an Irish handball from the late 1800s.
What we should do is get one of the alley crackers out and let you hit that with your bare hand.
Or we could let you just, like, slam it in the door.
Robert's laid-back, playful attitude permeates the place. Displays celebrate handball's greatest achievements and some of its worst gaffes. Roberts points to one of his favorites.
This is the very first one, and you'll see the date on there is April 10th, 1941. And anybody who knows anything knows that the Handball Union, USHA, came about in 1951. They made the 10-year mistake on the very first cover.
The USHA was formed more than a half century ago by Chicago developer Bob Kendler. Kendler then went on to standardize the rules of handball competition. But handball's been around since the first time somebody decided to pick up a round object and throw it against a wall. Homer, Alexander the Great, and Henry VIII are all noted in handball's annals. But it was the Irish who popularized the sport and brought it to the United States in the 19th century.
Handball has been a part of Irish history since at least the 15th century. Thanks in part to the ancient stone castles and monasteries that provided a convenient surface for players to hit the ball against.
3 years ago, Alley Cracker became the definitive, if not the only, handball documentary. It may have not been Oscar material, but it has a devoted fan base, including many who were in Tucson for the USHA's Masters Singles Tournament this March. Bob Rust is from Camarillo, California. Like other handball players, he calls his sport the perfect game. The claim makes sense. Chasing a rubber ball around a room as it travels 80 miles per hour takes concentration, agility, and endurance. But, Russ says, the draw is simple.
It's just so much fun. It's just a kid's game, and it's fun, and you get really avid about it. And, the reason I'm smiling is because I'm about to play a game of handball this afternoon. How could you be happier?
I had to look at Playtox over there. He had about 8 wins. Wow, that's fantastic.
Well, how about Nandy Alvarado?
Handball player Gene Perret looks younger than his actual age. He's here for the tournament, too, to play in the 80 and over category, and it's his first time at the museum. He's here with friends and marveling at the bios of his favorite players, including Joe Playtak, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1954 and who went on a grueling exhibition tour back in 1937.
Played 136 games in 21 days, 17 clubs in 13. My gosh. He didn't lose a single game or a doubles. Would you say he's pretty good?
Perret's favorite museum feature is the collection of vibrantly colored portraits of Hall of Fame players, done by Alvis Grant, a Hall of Famer himself. He points to guys like Vic Hershkowitz, who was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1957. Perret says in the 1950s, he saw Hershkowitz play Jim Jacobs, himself another Hall of Famer, and Mike Tyson's first boxing manager. Then there's Nadi Alvarado, who as a teenager came to the U.S. from Mexico. He's considered the Michael Jordan of handball. Alvarado currently holds a record with 11 national singles titles. Jean Perret says he's never been on the court with any of them, but that doesn't matter.
Oh, you just learn by watching these guys what you should do and what you shouldn't do. Then you try to go in and emulate them.
The buzz that surrounded the Hall of Fame on this tournament weekend was unusual. On most days, the Hall of Fame is sparsely attended or simply empty. Those few who do visit are greeted by receptionist Claudia Alvarez. She's there every day. Alvarez doesn't actually play handball, but plans to someday. Meanwhile, Vern Roberts sums up the Handball Hall of Fame experience.
It's a place for handball players to be proud of their heritage, and it's a place to honor the guys who have made handball what we consider the chess of the court sports.
For Only a Game, I'm Ann Hepperman in Tucson, Arizona.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Michael Garth. We had help this week from Jeff Heath at Smith College and from Kara Foster at member station WFCR in Amherst. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for the Only a Game newsletter, learn more about May the Best Team Win, or take a look at Keith Smart and his parrying cohorts, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from NBA nabob Scott Howard Cooper.
I think Shaq actually in physical presence is bigger than every arena and most of the buildings in the United States.
Well, there goes San Antonio's defensive strategy of double-teaming the big Aristotle with Tim Duncan and the Tower of the Americas. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.